Welcome to The Defiant. I'm your host, Tegan Klein. Today, I'm joined by nothing short of a legend, perhaps the Bitcoin greatest of all time, Jameson Lopp himself. Jameson is currently the CTO of Castle Hodl, a company specializing in Bitcoin security solutions, where he has played a pivotal role in developing products and services that empower individuals to safeguard their digital assets. Jameson is a globally recognized voice from his written work on cybersecurity, privacy, and the social implementations of Bitcoin. Trigger warning for those in the Ethereum community and beyond, as this is a spicy episode that gets gritty with the importance of individual privacy and protecting personal info in the digital age. And with that, Jameson talks to us briefly about what he's currently focused on at Casa.
Well, Casa's mission has always been to help people empower themselves. And that, of course, is helping people being their own bank at the moment. You know, we believe that cryptography and the technology that is being developed in this space is really all about empowering individuals. So it starts with Bitcoin, moves on to other assets, and we think that over the long term, it will turn into more than just a financial security service.
Absolutely. And helping people empower themselves is not the easiest feat. So I'm excited to circle back around to that a bit later in the episode. But first, I want to start off with your Bitcoin journey. So you were very early to the Bitcoin community. Can you talk to us a little bit about your origin story? How did you find Bitcoin? And what was that early Bitcoin career like?
People came into Bitcoin from a variety of different avenues. Mine was the nerd slash libertarian route. I'm pretty sure that the thing that initially got me to read the white paper was seeing Slashdot articles continue to come up over a period of several years. And I had ignored it for several years because I figured it was going to collapse and everybody was going to lose their money. But eventually I was like, okay, this thing is not going away. I should probably look into it. And once I read that white paper, the computer science and libertarian perspectives kind of coalesced and realized that, hey, this is a really interesting new project, and it actually makes me think of money in a way that I've never really looked at it before. So I got hooked after that and pretty quickly started coming up with my own side projects. And within a year or two, I was working full time in the space.
Amazing. And have you always been more on that libertarian side? Was there an aha moment for you that made you go more in that direction?
Over the course of my life, I've been everything. I was raised in a very conservative, traditional, Republican, WASPy household. Ended up going to an extremely liberal university and kind of flipped around the other way. I felt a bit disenfranchised after watching Obama continue a lot of the same policies, especially related to war and stuff. So I ended up becoming much more libertarian, probably right around the time when I was also getting into Bitcoin. And if anything, since then, that caused me to go even more extreme as I learned more about cypherpunks, their history, ideas around crypto anarchy. And now, being in these systems and seeing voluntary networks that are really crypto anarchic networks and sort of governance arising out of nothing has been fascinating to see. And I do believe that there's a lot of interesting lessons to be learned and experimentation that's happening at the governance level and just the how do we organize people to collectively work together towards achieving new goals.
Absolutely. And I think many people follow that similar trajectory over time. I think Ethereum is going through that today. I want to get into that a little bit later. But first, I want to talk about your time at BitGo. What was it like inside a Bitcoin startup in those early days?
Well, it was a lot like pretty much any other tech startup. You're not really sure how things are going to pan out. I think describing it as some long stretches of boredom spotted by sheer abject terror. Especially during the bear markets, it got pretty quiet and easy to get disillusioned, and then things come roaring back, or terrible things happen on the security side. And then, of course, as I'm sure we'll get into, there were also governance and philosophical debates going on within the entire community.
Yeah, let's jump into that. So at BitCo, at least, the CEO, Mike Belshi, was famously on the other side of the big blockers during the block size war in 2017. And that always seemed strange to me, given so many from the inside, yourself included, were on the other side. What was that like, and how did that all go down internally?
Well, so I was actually a big blocker for a couple of years. It wasn't until after I had been working at BitGo for a while and was responsible for running a lot of the node infrastructure that I started seeing a lot of the small blocker, layered scaling type of arguments as being much stronger. So I understood it. I had come from a big data distributed computing background, so my view of how you scaled systems was not particularly focused on like individual ability to run systems at scale. So, I saw both sides of it because I transitioned from one to the other. Really, I think the bigger point of contention was not so much that Mike was interested in on-chain scaling. It was more around the SegWit2x sort of corporate movement to try to break the stalemate by kind of forcing a fork through.
Got it. Okay, interesting. And honestly, if you read the Bitcoin white paper, Satoshi also may have been on that other side of the argument. I think so. Satoshi at times, alluded to this payment system, sometimes Bitcoin as a speculative store of value, and then even a registry system with Namecoin. What do you think Satoshi thought they were developing?
Well, Satoshi wasn't entirely sure. You can actually follow some of the changes that they made over that 2 year period or so that they were active. And they made mistakes. They learned things along the way and made changes. And I think it's very dangerous for people to focus on like what Satoshi would have wanted or what Satoshi would think today, because we've all been learning as this system has been evolving. And my own perspective has changed a lot. I think anyone who's been in for more than a cycle or two has probably changed their perspective. And so I think it's asking a lot to believe that Satoshi was, omniscient and in the first 2 years of Bitcoin that they had a great idea of what it would become. But, I think that they were just trying to build a system that was robust against every possible type of attack. And, however you were using that system, whether it was for transfer of value, store of value, even like domain registries or whatnot, they wanted all types of functionality to be possible. This was obvious from the fact that they put a scripting language into the system, though fairly early on, they disabled a lot of those opcodes for security reasons. But I think that at a very high level, Satoshi just wanted to build a system that could be a sort of public commons for us to agree upon, who owns what and who is able to manipulate this distributed ledger.
Absolutely. And I know you extensively studied the early days of Bitcoin, including the early mining patterns, when only a few people were on the network. And then you also studied Satoshi's early writings on the forums. What has most surprised you kind of early on that most people don't talk about?
Well, one thing is that Satoshi actually disappeared for a few lengthy stretches of time. They were not working round the clock all year long. Who knows if they went on vacation or they maybe got disillusioned for a bit and took a break. But there were several like month-long, if not longer, periods of time where there was absolutely no communications or activity from Satoshi. I think there was a book that chronicled some of that early history that basically gave a lot of credit to Marty Malamy, aka Sirius, as being one crucial early contributor who basically kept Bitcoin alive for certain parts of that first year, where you know they were still contributing, running nodes, running the website, and so on. And you know, if not for a handful of those very early contributors, I think the project very well could have died in its infancy.
Amazing. And that's one of the great things about these ecosystems, these decentralized ecosystems. And you recently said that Bitcoin is f*** you money. Can you tell us what you meant by that? And do you think Satoshi would agree if they were alive today or around today, I should say?
Yeah, it was funny. I actually asked Grok that same question this morning to see what the X AI thought about it. And it got a pretty good answer. But basically, you know, traditionally, you money has been considered to mean that you have a level of wealth that you know you are no longer constrained by what other people think of you or what they want to try to do to stop you. Basically, you can do what you want because you have the means to do what you want. I think there's a slightly different spin you can take with Bitcoin where it's not about the amount of wealth that you have. It's not about the amount of Bitcoin that you have. If you have any amount of Bitcoin, at least in self-custody, that you yourself are controlling with your own keys and you're following the rules of the protocol, then there is no third party, there is no authority who can tell you what to do or not to do. So, you know, if someone wants to confiscate your funds or if they want to inflate the money supply or otherwise, you know, screw with you as a Bitcoin user, they can't. And you don't even have to say F you. All you have to do is keep following the rules of the protocol.
Absolutely. And what would you say is Bitcoin's major accomplishment today from your view?
I think we've, at the very least, we've gotten the idea into the public conversation that money doesn't need to be what a few people tell us it is. I think the best way to describe this is before 2010 or so, if you went around talking about fiat money, people would just look at you weird. But now that we have, you know, Bitcoin, we have crypto, and now it makes more sense to be talking about fiat money because fiat money is no longer the only option. You know, people, of course, would talk about gold and silver and precious metals or whatever, but, you know, their utility was extremely limited in comparison to what we can now do with these new digital assets.
Absolutely. And why do you think Bitcoin survived when so many projects before it failed?
Well, Satoshi actually said it themselves. I think there was a quote where Satoshi said, "I hope it's clear that the reason that a lot of these early projects died was due to their centralized nature." You know, if you have a single company that is running the project, if you have a single point of failure, really in any regard, whether that's the entity that's like running the network or the database or really any crucial aspect of the project, of the system. If there are any single points of failure in that system, over a long enough period of time, one of them is probably going to get triggered and the whole thing is going to collapse.
Yeah. And why do you think Satoshi never touched the Bitcoin? Do you think they destroyed their keys out of fear of the government?
My thesis is that the million or so Bitcoin that are believed to have been mined by Satoshi were mined not because they had any intention of spending them, but rather because they had a dedicated custom mining machine. I mean, it was probably just a regular PC, but it definitely had custom mining software on it, and that they were using this machine for the first couple of years of the Bitcoin network's existence, essentially as a a heartbeat. It was basically to ensure that the blocks would keep getting mined at regular intervals, regardless of how many other people were mining. So this was essentially a bootstrapping mechanism that they used. And you can actually, you can look at the hash rate of the supposed Satoshi miner, and you can see that as other miners joined the network over that first couple year period, the Satoshi miner would actually intentionally in step functions decrease their own hash rate. So, you know, if Satoshi was trying to maximize the amount of coins that they were mining, which wouldn't really make sense because they had no value at the time, nobody knew what was going to happen. But if they were trying to maximize their total number of coins, then they would have kept going full steam ahead at 100% of their hash power. There's also pretty conclusive evidence that this machine was powered off half of the time, that they would actually, the machine would stop mining for about 5 minutes after it found a block. And I think part of the reason for that is Satoshi didn't want to overwhelm the network. They wanted to give plenty of possibilities, opportunities for other miners to come in and join and get some rewards and start being able to play around with Bitcoin.
So you think it was fully altruistic, but then don't you think there would still be a temptation to want to spend that at some point?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's difficult to imagine anyone sitting on billions and billions of dollars and not doing anything with it. On the flip side, though, you know, if I try to put myself in Satoshi's shoes, I probably wouldn't touch it either, because it's basically impossible to do in a private sense. Like if you believe that all of the like powerful nation states of the world are looking at this and going to be trying to track it and, you know, trace any movements back to you and your identity, it would be a really weird situation to be in. On one hand, you're theoretically one of the richest people in the world. On the other hand, if you try to spend your money, you put your life in intense danger.
That's a great thesis, and that makes a lot of sense. Okay, amazing. Okay, and then more controversially, what do you think Satoshi got wrong in the early design? One thing that keeps me up at night is, you know, as we get closer to all of the Bitcoins being mined, I'm worried that there's not enough incentive to the miners. And then what happens? Do we all collectively agree on a 1% inflation? And then once you cross that barrier, what stops you from becoming the monster that you're trying to fight against?
Sure. This is always theoretically possible, though it's one of those things that's, you know, many years away, I think, from becoming a crisis. But I'm pretty optimistic about the incentives. First of all, I think it's pretty amazing that Bitcoin has survived for 14 years. That basically shows that the incentives in the game theory that Satoshi constructed were quite robust. And I think that there is good reason to believe that those incentives will continue working as expected. And I mean, you only really have to look at what's been going on in the past few weeks and months. We've actually had periods of time in which the transaction fees have been greater than the block reward. And of course, since the block reward is getting cut in half in a few months, it's going to be even easier for transaction fees to more than offset that. So I think we already have at least some proof of concept that this is possible. Of course, there's so many different factors at play of really what will create demand for block space and therefore drive the transaction fees and help to pay for the miners and basically the thermodynamic security. It's also a tricky question because no one really knows what the quote unquote right amount of hash power or right amount of energy is that's needed to keep Bitcoin relatively secure. So Satoshi did get some things wrong though, and they fixed them. You know, they actually, in the very first releases of the Bitcoin client, they were incorrectly using the length of the blockchain to decide which fork of a valid blockchain was correct. And pretty quickly they realized that that wasn't great because anybody can just create a bunch of blocks with without much proof of work. So they fixed that pretty quickly to instead be whichever fork of the blockchain has the most proof of work is considered the best. And, you know, there were a number of other changes over the years of removing some opcodes that could have been used to essentially destroy the consensus of the network if they had been exploited. And beyond that, I think it's pretty clear that for the past 10 years or so, Bitcoin has functioned quite well, but where we're at now, it's more of a theoretical issue of, you know, what changes, if any, should be made to Bitcoin that will make it more valuable and more functional without accidentally introducing some exploit that could cause the whole system to fall apart. It's good that Bitcoin development is conservative and that people are thinking very adversarially about these things. But on the flip side, one thing that I think a lot of people don't keep in the back of their mind or they don't put enough weight in is the fact that this system is anti-fragile. Not because of the software, not because of the hardware. It's anti-fragile because of you and me and everyone else who is interested enough in watching what's happening, in contributing in whatever way we can, with whatever skills and resources we can. And that it's really hard for me to envision a catastrophe that would actually cause Bitcoin to fail permanently. We've seen plenty of examples where Bitcoin has failed temporarily due to technical issues. And what happens is if machine consensus stops, then you fall back to human consensus and then you fix the problem and you move forward. You know, this is why Bitcoin is resilient to almost anything. It's because it's comprised of now, you know, probably millions of people scattered all around the world who are incentivized in seeing it continue to succeed.
Absolutely. And I want to get into syncing a node and all of that in a moment. But first, I want to double click on why you're passionate about this industry. You mentioned empowerment, you alluded to freedom. Can you kind of double click there?
Yeah, so technology is a double-edged sword. You know, technology can both be a tool for freedom, but you can also assume that technology will be used by authoritarians to control and manipulate the masses. So I think anyone who pays attention to anything that's going on in the world is well aware of a lot of the surveillance and things that governments are doing to take advantage of technology to really more greatly empower themselves, you know, make themselves more aware of what people are doing and therefore able to, you know, manipulate them and guide them kind of in the ways that are most suitable to the government. So we need people on the other side of that where we can't just be creating, you know, theoretical technology. You know, Bitcoin has always theoretically allowed people to be their own bank. But if it's not practical, then, you know, the real world impact of the technology is going to be greatly minimized. So much like, for example, PGP, which is one of the strongest, like, communications privacy technologies in existence that has been around for several decades, It's an amazing technology from a privacy perspective, but nobody uses it because it's just not practical to do so. So, you know, I don't want Bitcoin or any of these other theoretically empowering technologies to go the way of PGP.
Absolutely. And that's why the work you're doing is so important. And I'm excited to chat about it in a moment. But you're one of the leading authorities on syncing a node. And I'm sure you spent countless hours testing Bitcoin software. Why do you consider the ability to sync a node to be so important for Bitcoin?
Yeah, I actually have a syncing test running right now as we're speaking, my annual syncing tests. So it comes down to the governance issue of what rules do you agree to? Or do you want to be sufficiently empowered that you know exactly what the rules are of whatever network you're using, of whatever project you have decided to put money into? How do you ensure that you don't get rugged by someone changing the rules? You know, this happens in traditional systems all the time because there's some central authority somewhere who dictates those rules and you have no say. You know, even in America, which is supposedly one of the world's greatest, you know, democratic republics, we get rugged by authorities at every level, be it local, state, or federal, because the rules are changing all the time. And unfortunately, we employ a lot of people whose job is to change those rules. So it can be hard to even, you know, stay apprised of all of the rule changes once a government becomes, you know, sufficiently large. So if you want to prevent yourself from having the rules changed right out from under you in a way that may harm you, then you need the ability to enforce those rules and validate that the rules are not being broken and changed. And that's where running a node comes in. You basically have to think of a node as sort of your own personal attorney slash accountant, where it's an automated sentry where every bit of activity that's going on passes through that node and it checks everything that's happening. And if anything's wrong, the node rejects that transaction, that block, that data, that whatever that attempted manipulation of the global ledger is. It just says no thank you, and it keeps chugging along. And so if it's possible for people to run this type of automated sentry to ensure that the rules aren't being changed, then the question becomes, okay, how much does it cost to do that? And I don't think you'll ever get a exact answer, but at least within Bitcoin, the answer is we want it to be as affordable as possible for people to be able to audit the system and ensure that the rules aren't being changed. Of course, that creates a number of conflicts and trade-offs with other things.
Absolutely. And if only you could vote people in to shrink the government instead of enlarge it, but maybe someday. And then more recently, how well has Bitcoin Core itself been improving? And what's your prognosis for maintaining the ability for home users to be able to sync with minimal cost?
So the one thing that we know for sure is that the size of the blockchain is just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, this is essentially an append-only ledger. It is possible, if you're running a node, it is possible for you to prune old data, but you still have to download it and verify it before you can throw it away. Though there's some other projects that are actually working to make even that more efficient. So, you know, how much is it going to cost also is related to the fact that technology at the hardware level continues to get better. So this is one of the reasons why I do this annual test, is if we know the blockchain is getting bigger, that means we have to process more and more data. And so that should take more and more time or more resources to be able to do, especially if you're starting from scratch. On the flip side, we know that computers and hardware are getting faster, so that should help mitigate the fact that the blockchain is getting bigger. And then the other variable is the software itself. And, you know, are there more improvements that can be made to improve the performance of the software? And that, in general, that seems to be quite true at many different layers of the software. And really, one of the interesting things about Bitcoin is that it seems to have incentivized the development and continued efficiency and performance of really, really low-level cryptographic signature verification. You know, there's an entire project with several people dedicated just to the SecP 256K1 elliptic signing curve that is used for a number of different Bitcoin operations. And it seems like every year they keep making it like 10 or 20% more performant. And that has a huge impact on node syncing operation when you're validating, you know, all of these transactions.
Absolutely. And is that how you would define decentralization, is the ability to kind of validate the state of the network yourself at low cost? Or how do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, decentralization is a bit of a trigger word because there are so many different aspects of these systems that you can try to quantify. And decentralization is also a spectrum. I get triggered when someone says something is decentralized. Sometimes if you say something is centralized, then it's very obvious because there's a single point of failure you can point to. But calling something simply decentralized is usually glossing over a lot of nuance. But certainly one big aspect of how decentralized these systems are how many nodes are running out there. You know, the more nodes there are, the more difficult it would be for any authority to try to shut them down or coerce them or force them to change things against the will of the node operator. And so, of course, the cost of running a node is going to have a sort of direct correlation to how many people decide to run one.
Absolutely. And I think decentralization oftentimes should be a means to censorship resistance, which is also a spectrum. Are you satisfied with Bitcoin's level of censorship resistance today?
It could be better. And there are some aspects that I'm not optimistic about. You know, Bitcoin has pretty poor privacy on chain, and that is related to censorship resistance. Unfortunately, I don't foresee really strong privacy happening at the base protocol level, because most of the really strong privacy potential changes would be in direct conflict with the desire to be able to easily audit the entire money supply, for example. So you get into a lot of weird minutiae and trade-offs for these things. There's also issues kind of at the mining level of the fact that the industrialization of mining has made it more centralized than I'm comfortable with. And I'm hopeful that we'll eventually get to the point where it will make sense for people, for more of the quote unquote average people, or at least nerdy Bitcoiners, to be doing small scale mining at home because they're able to reuse the waste heat for other purposes.
Absolutely. And we talked about why someone would set up a home node. What's your recommendation for setting one up?
I would generally recommend someone go use some of the more user-friendly software or even plug-and-play hardware out there. So if you check out my website at lop.net, I've got a whole section for running a node, and there's plug-and-play hardware from companies like Umbral and Start9 and Samurai. And basically, these are projects that they've built a lot of other software around the node that makes it a lot easier for you to run it and manage it and see what's going on, as opposed to just downloading Bitcoin Core directly and running it yourself.
Amazing. And your website has so many great resources, so I recommend the listeners check it out. And then speaking of recommendations, you were subject to a swatting in 2017. Can you tell us a little bit about that story and how it led you to become more of a privacy maximalist, if you will?
Yeah, basically, I grew to a level of prominence on social media that, it's a law of large numbers type of thing. If you have enough people whose attention is focused on you, then eventually somebody out there is going to be malicious or willing to do naughty things. So, I basically got extorted. These people thought that they could screw around with me and scare me and get me to pay them off. And it actually turned into a multi-year life-changing event, and eventually a hunt for me to track them down. And I did eventually get them and got a little bit of justice. It it didn't feel quite as good as it could have because it ended up being some punk teenager who just, he didn't really know any better. But, you know, this resulted in me understanding that there was actually a vulnerability at the law enforcement level, at least in America, where we have created protocols at our law enforcement level such that if you make a phone call and you say the right words, it will trigger a lethal force response by law enforcement. Even in my case, where law enforcement was already very suspicious because the call came from a different state and it was claiming to be me in my house with hostages and weapons and stuff, they were still obligated by their own internal policies to go, you know, check out the potential threat and do so with a level of extreme force. So the problem here is that the only way you can prevent law enforcement from being pointed at you as a weapon by a bad guy who knows how to manipulate them and say the right words, the only way to prevent that is to ensure that nobody can find your physical location to be able to call up your local law enforcement and, you know, pretend that something terrible is going on at your physical address. So, you know, swatting was not a particularly new thing. It had been around for over a decade, but as is the case with a number of other types of criminal activity on the internet, Bitcoin has changed the incentives. So just kind of like the fact that ransomware was a law, it was a thing long before Bitcoin existed. Ransomware is very small because it was very difficult to get the payments. So once it was possible for you to write your ransomware in a way that said, oh, you have to send Bitcoin to this address, you know, the return on investment for being a ransomware author increased greatly. So the same thing really happening with folks who are trying to extort other people, whether that's through swatting or other types of cybercrime.
Well, I'm sorry that happened to you. And what's your recommendation to prevent that? I assume using a VPN, maybe setting up your home under an LLC and not your real name. Anything else that you can share around best practices?
On the bright side, very few people will ever have to worry about this because you have to make enemies, or you have to rise to a level of prominence that someone believes that they can screw with you and get a payoff. So, you know, if you're the average person who is not like a controversial figure on social media, you'll probably be okay. But the flip side is that you don't necessarily know. Due to the way that social media works, it's now possible for you to go from being a nobody to being someone who has the ire of millions of people directed at them. You know, it's possible to be someone who only has like 100 followers on social media, but if you post the right series of words that are like sufficiently controversial and it goes viral, you know, you can have millions or tens of millions of people really pissed off at you. And once again, and then you get into that same situation where you have millions or tens of millions of people whose attention are focused at you. There may be one or two people in there who decide to do something about it and, you know, basically attack you in a way that you never anticipated. So I consider, as a result, strong privacy. You should really think of this as a shield or a type of insurance against these unknown type of attacks. The best way to prevent yourself from getting attacked is to make it so that nobody knows, you know, where you are or what you're doing. You just don't give people a target in the first place. Of course, you could take that a step further and say, like, if you really don't want to get attacked, just don't use social media. But for a lot of us, I think that's not quite a tenable proposition.
Absolutely. And I think that privacy should be a human right. But I find that most people don't understand privacy and oftentimes will think you're a criminal or even accuse you of being a criminal for wanting privacy.
Step into the decentralized internet foundation of open data with The Graph. Since 2018, The Graph has been the cornerstone of Web3 data, standardizing subgraphs and serving over 1 trillion queries across 40 plus blockchains. With over 88,000 plus subgraphs and a thriving ecosystem of developers, indexers, and curators, The Graph isn't just a data marketplace, it's a revolution in the Web3 space. Now, with the recent launch of the Sunrise Plan, many new subgraphs are joining the network and queries are on the rise. It's the perfect time to delegate and support the sunrise of decentralized data. Embrace a world where data APIs, new query languages, and diverse Web3 use cases flourish. Your journey in shaping the future of open, decentralized data begins at The Graph. Learn more at thegraph.com/start.
How has being kind of this privacy maximalist impacted your personal and professional life?
Well, it makes small talk very difficult. Most small talk is actually the sharing of personal information. So a lot of times when I am conversing with people, I have to have, you know, alternative options. If they know who I really am, like I'm at a conference or something, then I generally just have to deflect. But the thing is, with my setup, like my actual neighbors and friends where I spend my time don't know who I am. I have this entirely separate persona and pseudonym. And so, you know, I have to have my backstory for that. And that, for the first year or two, it can be pretty tough to be able to maintain that. Eventually, you get used to it. It just sort of becomes second nature. But, you know, this is extreme privacy. Very, very few people go to these lengths because it causes a lot of friction. I have to maintain like dozens of different email addresses and phone numbers and throw away credit cards. And, you know, my life is a lot more complicated as a result.
Has anyone ever found out your real identity and felt, I don't know, maybe betrayed?
No, so far so good.
Okay, amazing. Wow, that is impressive.
It's probably only a matter of time. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the trade-offs or potential problems of being a prominent figure in the space. I don't want to become more prominent in the sense of I don't want to become sort of mainstream level prominence, because then I would have actual issues, you know, walking around in real life and having people potentially recognize me and follow me.
And any good resources that you can recommend for maybe someone listening who wants to improve their privacy?
Well, I once again have an entire privacy section on my website. And in general, if anyone wants extreme privacy, I actually recommend buying the book, Extreme Privacy by Michael Bazell. That's the book that I wish had existed when I had embarked upon my journey.
Thank you. All right, let's shift gears and talk about the work you're doing at Casa. Tell us a little bit about the products and services that you all provide.
Yeah, I think the best way to think of Casa is that we help people be their own bank. We help people be them really empower themselves using technology. You know, we're trying to make it easier for them to do so. It kind of goes back to what I was saying, you know, the difference between the sort of theoretical and the practical functionalities that these protocols are enabling. We take the best practices that I've learned from working in the space over the past decade and seeing a lot of catastrophes. We combine that with some of the best hardware and software technologies, and then finally package it up with a level of service that's basically unheard of in the space, but you're paying for it. So, you know, unlike a lot of wallets out there that are quote unquote free, and of course free basically means that they're finding some other way to monetize it. With Casa, you're actually paying us a subscription fee. And in return for that, you get a level of service that you can't really get at from other wallets or even custodians. We really exist to provide people with a concierge level of service so that whenever you run into a problem, whenever you have decisions that need to be made and you want to best understand the trade-offs, because when it comes to managing keys and doing self-custody, there are many, many decisions. And each of these decisions is almost always a trade-off between security and convenience. And so we're helping people navigate a lot of these decision trees and put them into a setup that is more robust than really anything else out there. And then once you're happy with your setup, we can talk about other things such as inheritance planning, which gets even more complicated.
Absolutely. And yeah, one thing that I found interesting was just that Casa, you do have to attach it to an email or a phone number. So it's not private, but to your point earlier, you have to make this accessible. Otherwise, people won't use it. So do you find that people generally will start with Casa and then maybe go to a more private option in the future?
So this is tough. If you want extreme privacy with your self-custody, the trade-off there is that you can't ask for help. You literally have to do everything yourself. And for the privacy maximalist, if you're willing to put in the time and the effort, of course, this is the freedom of the protocols. Like you can set up whatever you want. The problem with going the lone wolf route is that it's a lot more likely for you to accidentally introduce a single point of failure or for you to overlook a potential foot gun that may not bite you, maybe even for several years. You may be going along for quite a while very well, and then some problem arises and you discover that you may be locked out of your own funds. I've seen a lot of things go wrong. So there's a reason why Casa puts people into a architecture in which we have a diverse setup of your keys. You'll have one key that's on software on your phone, several keys that are on hardware devices that are distributed around different locations. And then very importantly, Casa will hold a key too. And the reason for that is that this diversity is strength, in that when you start to analyze all of the potential attack and loss vectors, any single attack or loss that might happen to any given key is then going to be limited to that one key and will not affect enough keys of your setup that will cause you to actually lose access to your money. And this includes like you doing stupid things like running your keys through the washing machine or something. I don't know. And the fact that Casa holds one of those keys, we don't have the ability to actually move your money, but we can work with you to co-sign a transaction in the event that some of your other keys have been lost or compromised.
And you all advocate a multi-signature solution. And from what I've read, you consider multi-sigs to be superior to other schemes such as like Shamir secret sharing, which I'm terrified to do because I think I would screw it up. Talk to us a little bit about the trade-offs.
Right. Well, Shamir secret sharing has several problems, one of which is that it's difficult to actually do Shamir secret sharing correctly. There have been a few incidents over the years where various Shamir secret sharing schemes were developed and found actually to be vulnerable in the sense that people could reconstitute the keys with fewer shares than were supposedly possible or required to do so. There's also some auditability issues there where you actually have no idea which shares were used to reconstruct the key and sign a transaction. Also, it requires you to actually reconstitute the key in one single place. So, you know, what happens is you have a key and it essentially gets split out into many shares. But then in order to use the key, you have to get the shares all back together and reconstitute the key. So that is a single point of failure. There are, you know, things that can go wrong at that point. There's also multi-party computation, which is a slightly newer thing. And one of the problems there is that multi-party computation is, as far as I'm aware, it's not supported by any dedicated air-gapped hardware devices. You basically end up having to have all of your different keys on internet-connected devices. So that in and of itself, I think, is it's a big red flag. You don't want key material, or at least you don't want a sufficient quorum of key material to be on an internet-connected device, because everything that's connected to the internet, you have a door there that, you know, billions of people could be knocking on and trying to get through. The nice thing about multisig is that it is extremely simple. Like I said, Shamir secret sharing and MPC are both much more complicated protocols, whereas at least in Bitcoin, the multisig is built into the protocol, and it's literally like seven words when you're creating a Bitcoin script. And you want to say, you know, I want to do like a 3 of 5 multisig. It's like one line of code, essentially. It's a bit more complicated when you get into Ethereum and EVMs, because you have to write your own smart contract or use a multisig smart contract. So we've built on top of Gnosis Safe, which is a multisig technology that's been around for 5 or 6 years and has tens of billions of dollars secured in it without incident for many years. So like I said, we try to take the best of what's out there and apply it and make it easier for people to use.
Absolutely. And red-pilling people on self-custody is not easy. Can you talk to us a little bit about how that's been for you?
Even just getting people to understand like why they should care about Bitcoin and alternative assets is hard enough. These days, I try to mostly focus on the many, many real world historical catastrophes that have happened. You rarely have to go back in time more than a few months to find some catastrophe that wouldn't have happened if people had been holding their own keys. And so, of course, there were quite a few catastrophes last year with, I guess, tens of billions of dollars lost because people were trusting others to hold onto their keys for them. And it's not going to stop. This is human nature that humans tend to take the path of least resistance, and they tend to prefer convenience over security and privacy and other attributes. And as a result, that's going to continue to result in a lot of hard lessons being learned, especially every new wave, every new cycle of people that come in. They're going to have to relearn the same hard lessons that the rest of us have.
Absolutely. And hopefully no one has to learn that lesson twice. And let's talk a little bit about Ethereum, because recently Casa got in a bit of hot water in the Bitcoin circles for supporting Ethereum. Can you talk a little bit about what drove that decision?
Well, I think a lot of people who are angry about that don't really understand Casa or what our market is. We've generally, well, from inception, we've targeted the people who have the most to lose, aka the whales, the early adopters, or even more recently, especially post-pandemic, we saw a lot more traditionally wealthy people start to diversify in their assets into the space. So we listened to our customers, and we had more and more of not just our current customers, but our sales team telling us we were losing potential customers, because if someone was coming in, they were evaluating all the different options out there. And when they would get to the list of, okay, well, you know, which assets do you support? And we were like, you know, Bitcoin only. And they were like, okay, I need you to be able to support multiple assets. And it was usually Bitcoin plus Ethereum and plus, you know, probably Ethereum-based tokens or stablecoins or whatnot. So, you know, that was what drove the decision there, is that, you know, we didn't think it made sense to continue limiting our market, and that we knew that when we were adding support for Ethereum, it was not going to affect the security of our Bitcoin product. You know, these are completely separate ways of storing and manipulating the keys. So, you know, people who don't like Ethereum don't have to use it in our product. They can certainly use Bitcoin only. But then over the past year or so, this past bear market, we really saw the rise of stablecoins. And so we believe that, you know, there's a lot of demand for stablecoins. And of course, most of those, that volume is happening with Ethereum-based stablecoins. So that's why we actually just launched stablecoin support a week or so ago.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah, now we just need a more decentralized stablecoin. And it reminds me of when Jesse of Kraken, who's also more of a Bitcoin maximalist, supported Ethereum before Coinbase, and that was a crucible moment for them.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially if you're operating an exchange, you want your market to be as large as possible, and that means exchanges are actually incentivized to go out and support the long tail of a lot of these assets, because every new trading pair is going to be in more volume, which is going to be in more fees for them.
So putting aside the business needs, how do you feel about Ethereum from kind of a cypherpunk security standpoint?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know the stats off the top of my head, but it feels like, on the privacy front, like with Tornado Cash, Ethereum has had more coverage and controversy than, I guess, with some of the Bitcoin mixers. I've generally been kind of bearish on Bitcoin mixing, and that's mainly from an economics standpoint, but also from a standpoint of managing the UTXOs. With Bitcoin mixing, there's just a lot of possible ways to screw it up. It's not just a magic thing of, oh, you put your Bitcoin through the mixer and now you have great privacy. So it you might be able to make an argument that like Ethereum's account-based model is actually more user-friendly for more practical mixing privacy there. But other than that, you know, these are very different networks, right? Ethereum's trying to be more of a general purpose network, which is interesting because I think it allows for the narratives to shift a bit faster. You only really need, you know, a handful of people to build a new dApp that becomes explosively popular for it to potentially significantly impact the, you know, the driving force behind demand for ETH. And of course, the original point of ETH was just to pay gas for whatever, you know, your smart contract and dApp interactions are. So it seems like that is really what Ethereum should be going for from a value perspective, is just letting as many people do as many things as possible on the network, which should drive more demand for gas. You know, Bitcoin's a bit trickier because it's less flexible. It's harder to change, and you have to take more of a layered approach, I think, if you want to do more complex stuff and not have to deal with the morass of trying to navigate the, you know, consensus change governance process. So I don't know. I don't even really consider them to be in direct competition with each other. I think a lot of people are, you could call them maximalists or whatever, but I think a lot of people are perfectly happy for Bitcoin to be the more conservative, stable protocol that doesn't change very much, that you know, that stability also helps to drive the value of the fact that people are less concerned that they're going to be, you know, rug pulled by rule changes. Whereas Ethereum has for quite a while felt to be more like a, you know, Silicon Valley tech startup type of ethos of, we're just going to like try a whole bunch of things and see what sticks.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess with that, you don't buy the ETH is money narrative.
No, not so much. I mean, I'm sure people have their own arguments for it, but I've always viewed it as, you know, ETH is for powering smart contracts. Now, what is money? You know, that turns into a whole other argument. I mean, it seems like you can use almost anything as money if it has sufficiently good properties that people can agree to use it as such.
Absolutely. Okay. And now, you know, Ethereum kind of started out with this progressive and maybe even kind of statist bent. And they've come around, or I've found that many in the community have come around to Bitcoin's more libertarian and adversarial thinking. Do you see that as well? Kind of, you know, we trust the government, but now they're kind of learning that maybe that's not the most wise approach.
Well, it's tough for me to comment too much on the community because I'm not as attuned to what's going on in Ethereum land. You know, I think some people would point to some of the centralization and staking as being problematic. I'm not sure if there are like projects or much progress being made to try to fix some of those incentives that have caused so much centralization and staking. As I said, though, you know, there's more centralization in Bitcoin mining than I would like. It can get really tricky to try to compare these things because I think it's kind of like apples and oranges. But I do believe that Ethereum is not going away. You know, I think that it has achieved escape velocity, if you will, on at least some of the parameters of decentralization, such that it's, you know, it's sufficiently dispersed that there are enough people working on it that it would be very difficult to kill the system, even if there was a critical problem.
Agreed. And what I've found is many developers in the Ethereum community, they maybe started with Bitcoin, the Bitcoin community, and they found the developers to be a little bit harsh. And then they came to Ethereum, mm-hmm. and it's more rainbows and butterflies. Can you speak to that harshness of the Bitcoin developers? And actually, maybe it's an important component to this whole puzzle.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the reason of why I kind of used the Silicon Valley tech startup mindset. It's more of a like experimentation versus just don't break it type of mindset. And I don't know, I would say that, you know, Ethereum is probably starting to move more towards that as well. And, you know, why is this the case? At the very least, I think it's fair to say that when you have less to lose, you're more likely to be a risk taker. You know, when the value of your crypto network is only a few million dollars or even a few hundred million dollars, and you've got these behemoths that are, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, then it probably feels like, you know, you need to try different things and differentiate yourself. And all of these networks, you know, even Bitcoin to an extent, they're still trying to find the best product market fit, and they're all trying to maximize, you know, their total addressable market. So if you think about these networks from more of a product standpoint, then it's still the early days. You know, none of these networks have even probably 100 million users regularly. And so they've got scaling challenges. They've got usability challenges and overall functionality issues of what can and can't be done. So I think it makes sense that they're not all taking the same direction. Look at it from like a perspective of trying to compete in different markets. It would make less sense for all of these projects to try to compete over the exact same market because, they're going to be all fighting over one pie. It's a lot better for them to be trying to get, different pies so that whatever slice of the pie of the market you're getting, you're not competing as hard over it with, other networks and protocols.
Absolutely. And I think it's more positive sum in crypto, or at least it should be. And the real enemies are outside of crypto, or at least they should be. And, I do agree that the balance sheet growth made a lot of people have to kind of grow up quickly in the space. And kind of looking forward from the early days, what surprised you most in terms of how Bitcoin or even maybe crypto has evolved over time?
Well, it's progressed a lot faster than I expected. I was thinking of this as being more of a generational type of project. So, when I originally bought Bitcoin many years ago, I kind of looked at it like a gold hedge of like, I don't know necessarily what the value of Bitcoin is going to be or that it's going to go up insanely, but I'm confident that the value of fiat is going to continue to go down because they're going to keep printing more and more of it. And I know exactly how much Bitcoin is going to get quote unquote printed. Then when you start looking at these other networks, especially the smaller, newer projects, they have a lot more maneuverability to try new things, and they may crash and burn. And really, we should expect that the vast majority of projects in the space crash and burn. It's just like the majority of small businesses don't last more than a couple of years. But that's sort of the nature of capitalism and advancing technology and civilization in general, is we have to experiment, we have to be willing to fail and keep moving forward. But as we said, if you do succeed to a level where you're now somewhat responsible for the stewardship of a $100 billion or even $1 trillion network, then yes, the pressures change a bit more. And so it turns less into we need to innovate and move fast and more into we need to be very careful not to break this amazingly valuable thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, the kids these days, they don't want gold. They would prefer digital assets like Bitcoin. And at the NFT boom surprised me tremendously, but kind of in hindsight, I should have seen that coming as well, because the kids don't want physical art. They would prefer digital art to show all of their friends all over the world online. So interesting.
Yeah. I mean, NFTs is like everything that you don't know about art plus everything that you don't know about crypto. I can't really claim that I've ever understood the NFT stuff myself, and I even have a Bitcoin Wizard PFP. So,
and did you ever expect Bitcoin over 40K?
No, not in the first dozen or so years of its existence. When I got in, it was a single digit dollars, and imagining that many thousands of percent growth never even really crossed my mind. So I think the bright side of this is that I didn't get into this for like speculative or trading purposes, and the result of that is that I think, unlike a lot of people, I've been less prone to, dump my coins because the price doubled or whatever. It's never been about the fiat exchange rate. It's been about sticking it to the man and saying, no, you cannot inflate away my wealth.
And how do you see the next few years of Bitcoin's evolution? Can you talk to us a little bit about the roadmap as you see it?
Yeah, it's going to be tough. I've actually spent a decent amount of my like presentations at conferences and stuff this past year talking about my worries with regard to what I would call the ossification movement. And this really ties into the fact of what we've been saying. You know, you have a $1 trillion asset. A lot of people are going to get really afraid that you can't touch it because you might break it and everybody loses their money. But I've been going back in history, you know, looking at other protocols and how they've evolved, and been trying to make some points that, you know, both software and protocols, they need to continually be maintained and improved. Otherwise, they're likely to become worse. And I like to use SMTP, which is the email protocol, as an example for that. Though you could pick any number of popular internet protocols that have effectively ossified. And what does that mean? It basically means the protocol, it doesn't change anymore. And the reason it doesn't change is because it's just too difficult to coordinate a change, because there's so many people that are running software on machines. They can't all, you know, update in concert with each other. And if you make a change, it's kind of like changing language. You know, it's like if we were in America right now and the government told us, okay, starting on January 1st, the official language of America is Esperanto. You know, that's like the level of conflict and disruption that could be caused when you have a protocol that's being used by billions of people suddenly changing. I'm going to continue, you know, pushing for improvements, but you know that gets contentious as well. What I really want to see is I want improvements that will improve the security of what we can do for people in self-custody. And I think there's stuff around covenants and vaults that could help improve that. I am most interested in anything that I think will act as a boost for permissionless innovation. So there are a few potential low-level protocol changes that could make it easier for people to build other layers and, you know, complete other networks and sidechains that are Bitcoin adjacent, but in a way such that you don't have to go through the gauntlet of, you know, Bitcoin consensus change if you want to do something really novel and out there. And you know, there's always more room for improved efficiency, and there's things that we can do to make Bitcoin act as a cryptographic accumulator better. And what do I mean by that? Basically, anything that can act as a multiplier effect for an on-chain transaction. So the best example of that right now is Lightning Network, where you make an on-chain transaction and then you can basically make theoretically unlimited off-chain transactions that are really fast and cheap, and then they essentially all get consolidated and settled back down with one other on-chain transaction at some point in the future. And there are things that we can do to make that process even more efficient, for example, so that many, many people could share one of those on-chain transactions for opening and closing Lightning channels. Because, you know, the Bitcoin block space is very scarce and it is becoming more expensive. And that's some of the drama that we're seeing right now is, you know, people complaining about how other people are using Bitcoin because they're driving demand for block space, and that prices out low value transactions. And it's kind of like the scaling wars 2.0, just a slightly different twist.
Absolutely. Okay, amazing. Thanks for diving into that. I'm going to ask you one question that I wasn't going to ask you because I don't know if I fully formulated the thought, but maybe you'll help me finish it, and then we'll ask you the final question and let you go. But you know, one thing that I think about often is one of the flaws around Bitcoin is that those that were early, or those that are early to Bitcoin that actually held, have such kind of a disproportionate level of wealth compared to those that get in over time. Do you have any thoughts on that? Do you think about that at all?
Not in as much as that I think it's no different than anything else. The people who got into Apple stock early and held did really well. The people who got into Amazon early did really well. But just because you got in early doesn't mean that you held. I would say probably the vast majority of people who got in early on any of these things that became extremely valuable, it's human nature. You know, if you like double or triple your money, it's kind of human nature to like take some off the table, right? You want to realize those profits. So, I think this is just capitalism. It's how markets work, that the money will distribute itself, but I'd have no reason to believe that the wealth will be distributed any differently than it has throughout human history through other systems. Yeah, Bitcoin does not fix wealth distribution. I mean, I think that's just the nature of capitalism.
Absolutely, and that's an optimistic take. Okay, amazing. And yes, the hardest part is holding. So lastly, how are you defiant?
Well, a few years ago, I actually gave a talk entitled DeFi for Defiance, in which I was kind of ragging on a lot of the DeFi systems out there for having single points of failure. So especially in the Bitcoin circles, there's a lot of poking fun at DeFi because it's not as defiant as it probably should be. But I'm optimistic that we will continue to improve DeFi. And now, of course, there's the whole Bitcoin DeFi movement happening with various Bitcoin-related technologies. So it'll be interesting to see how like Bitcoin DeFi compares to like Ethereum and Solana and all of these other DeFi ecosystems, to see if the Bitcoiners do take a slightly different take on it. But I am defiant in as many ways as is practical to be, and I mean, one of those most fundamental ways is the fact that I've built my company in such a way that even if the government decides to come in and shut us down, they can't take our clients' money. You know, they can stop me, they can stop CASA, but our clients' funds are outside of everyone's control except for our clients.
It's very important, yeah, the censorship-resistant nature of it. And I do think DeFi should probably rebrand to TransparencyFi. And I tweeted that at one point, but then deleted it because I didn't want it to be misconstrued and then I get canceled. But that really is what DeFi is about today. It's more about the transparent nature of it. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate you staying extra time. Thank you so much, Jameson.
Thanks for having me.